Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 3. Coming up on the show, we've got the Five Fleets of Pan, the Dark Matter Pilot Wave, and our Pygmy God Ancestors. I'm Benjamin Grundy, joining me is Aaron Wright.
Oh, is this a follow-on to the weird Ewok creatures that were sneaking into that guy's bedroom on the last episode?
No, totally unrelated.
Oh, completely.
I just like talking about little guys on this show. It's fun.
Yes, we keep on coming up with these diminutive little beings, don't we?
Yeah, I was going into Susan Martinez's 2013 book, The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man. And it was funny because I saw a tweet by Greg Little, former guest on the show.
Of course, yeah.
He was tweeting about new genetic research that is opening up ideas of migration from Polynesians into South America.
Oh.
And there's multiple routes now due to genetic discoveries that showed that they possibly came in past New Zealand and then, through the Southern Hemisphere down to the lower tip of South America. And I looked at that and I realized, there's a much simpler explanation.
Which is?
Because if you look at these migratory theories of ancient people, it's very complicated. They're going over land bridges, they're traveling all over the place, long stretching arrows showing people spreading out everywhere. I've got a simpler explanation. They all just came from one source.
You mean as in one landmass?
That's what I'm going to be talking about on this show. And that's what's related to our pygmy god ancestors.
Oh, okay. I'm intrigued. I'm looking forward to that.
And then they were just all killed by storks. Remember that?
Yeah.
They were just all killed off by giant birds.
I do recall that. Where was that?
We covered that.
Was that a folkloric tale? Where was that from, though?
It's in all these cultures across the world. Tales of little people being killed off by giant birds. Okay. Didn't matter where you go. It was Polynesia Europe and ancient Sumeria.
Yeah, birds are bastards. They really are. Yeah. And you only just recently covered that story of an eagle or a hawk or something snatching a kid.
Yeah, well, was that in Switzerland or something?
Yeah, just like crazy stories. Well, I'm going to go into something actually a little bit similar in the Plus extension later on in the show, because after I've been looking at all this doppelganger and Vardiga kind of research, it started to kind of coalesce into these theories about how some people actually have doppelganger experiences where it's not a doppelganger of their own body. It's like their consciousness is replicated, but it's replicated in an animal of some kind.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a weird werewolf kind of story. It's got like these really ancient folkloric kind of connections, which may explain why we've got these stories about were-animals going so far back. It's like this natural, innate phenomenon that occurs, that when you're in this hypnagogic state or under the effect of drugs, you actually have a doppelganger, like a double of you that's created, but it takes on an animal form and does crazy wild things. It's birds.
It doesn't inhabit an existing animal.
No, it manifests.
That's what we hear from the shaman stories.
That's right. Well, then that kind of thing does pop up in some of these cases, but it's not really that. It's not a possession of an animal. It's not like a shaman describing, taking over a leopard or a cheetah or something like that. It's more about this unknown substance that we often describe that manifests in different ways. And in this particular circumstance, it's a doppelganger of you. But guess what is one of the stories that seems to come up repeatedly is that when people have these experiences, when they leave their body, and typically with out-of-body experiences that, move into doppelganger territory, you have stories of people kind of getting up with their body, in the night, and they look over back at their bed and their body's still lying there. There's a whole heap of stories of finding birds flying out of their mouths.
What?
The bird is their like doppelganger spirit flies out of their mouth and goes off and does what it has to do in the night, transforming into other animals before flying back into the human body, back in through their mouth, allegedly, according to these ancient tales.
So it's like a kind of astral travel.
Yeah, in a way, but it takes on this bird-like form. So we'll go into all of that later on in the show, but should we just jump straight into this weird pygmy people, Ben?
Yeah, this is the mysterious origins of hybrid man. And Martinez is, she's got a doctorate in anthropology from Columbia, but she's been a writer for years. I'll link to a bunch of her books in the show notes, and I'm sure we've covered quite a few of them in the past. But this is very critical of Darwinian evolution, the evolution of man, of Homo sapiens. She argues very early on that it's become dogma, which it has, and it's like our state-approved mythology.
Yeah.
To question it is extremely subversive.
Yep.
To question it in any kind of
You're shot down, you're cancelled, especially in academic circles.
Exactly.
You're
in any
insane.
Professional capacity, it's career destroying to have this kind of point of view.
And yet not many people know about Darwin's family member that was quite the proponent of eugenics. So
oh, that's right.
Not
was it
often
his
said.
Cousin,
was his cousin?
Right.
Yes.
Play by the rules or you're out of the game, she says. And she points out, she starts talking about all the money tied in with academic research, and breakthroughs in evolution are the cash cow. And she's got a great quote from Michael Crichton that said, scientists are in exactly the same position as Renaissance painters commissioned to make the portrait the patron wants done. The system works against problem solving, because if you solve a problem, your funding ends.
Oh, very astute. I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, scientists are only too aware whom they're working for. Those who fund research always have a particular outcome in mind, which is absolutely true. So Susan says for 40 years, she too had learned to avoid this topic and not voice any opinions on it because it would ruin you. But she says after researching to write the previous book before this one, which was on the history of pygmies, she said because of her research into pygmies, the entire house of cards of human evolution came crashing down.
Well, of course, you know, even pygmies are a controversial subject in any way.
I can't recall going into exactly why pygmies started to crash it, but I think we'll understand it once I go into this. She said she couldn't turn back. She had to start writing about this. And the whole book is based on the premise that the races of man don't, didn't, can't, and couldn't change or evolve physically to become something else. She says, notwithstanding hypothetical family trees and even more fanciful common ancestors, the question of origins today remains completely unsettled and open to interpretation. What evolutionists call change is, in her book, she says, simply the result of co-mingling, different races mixing genes. Evolution's transmutation of species reminds me, she says, of nothing so much as the medieval transmutation of lead into gold, an alchemy fed by legend, ambition, and illusion. So we've got a show on ancient race mixing. Sweet. This is where we're going on
we're
the
in.
Show. So what is this race mixing, this intermixing of ancient people? Well, she sets the scene with a cast of characters. And these, she says, are our ancestors. These are the five races of men. And she actually borrows the names from the OASB Bible. Remember the OASB Bible?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
It's that spiritualist text that was written by an American dentist in the late 1800s.
Oh, yes. Mm.
And he basically, I don't know if you could, I guess you could say he channeled it. It was automatic writing.
Yeah.
And it contains a chronology of the earth and all these so-called insights that are missing from biblical history. I don't know a lot about it, but she's an expert on it. And she takes the names that are mentioned in the OASB Bible and she just borrows them and uses them because they fit perfectly with what she started to understand about the true history of the origins of mankind. So the first race of man is known as the Asu. This is the first Adam, but they're basically beast-like upright men. This would be a close precursor to Australopithecus, dwelling on land and in trees, no speech, no real kind of consciousness, no spark of divinity, but so, that's the first man.
But rather Bigfoot-esque.
Yeah, they're covered in hair, but they're not apes.
No.
They're not apes, they're men. Asu means man without spirit. So you can think, of them as beasts, but they're not animals. The second race of man is the Ihin. Now, these are the sacred little people, 3 feet tall. The first AMH, which is anatomically modern humans, Europoid features, so pale skin, blonde, sandy hair, same kind of chiseled nose and that kind of thing. And they're the rootstock of Homo sapiens pygmaeus, which is the current understanding of these, hominids that have been found in history, the fossils. But they're like the biblical Abel.
Okay.
They have sentience. They can think, they can understand, they have a divine connection to God, they commune spiritually.
And they're killed off by their brothers?
Yeah, so we'll get into that. There's some fascinating stuff she starts to unpack. They appeared on Earth 6,000 years after the first generation of the first one, the Asu, mm-hmm. the dummies. The third race of man is the Druk. Now, this is a cross, a forbidden intermixing. This is the offspring of the Ihin and the Asu, the little people and the hairy dummies. And you're just like, what happened there? Really drunk. Like really, really drunk. Or rape, or probably rape.
Well, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, they really took one for the team.
That's true. This is a cross between Asu and the Ihin, the equivalent in many cases to Homo erectus, she says, and also to the biblical Cain, also known as the ground people, the pit dwellers, omnivorous, long-armed, curved back, often quite large. So the Druk are also the giants from history.
Mm-hmm. Are these red-headed giants or it's just...
Well, that's a part of it and we'll get into that as well. The fourth race is the Ihwan. And they appeared around 39 to 20,000 years ago. This is a cross between the little people and the giants. Best known as the Aurignacian or Solutrean Cro-Magnon in Europe. Tall, strong, copper-colored, mighty men. These are the large men with the red hair. So there's kind of a crossover with the reports of giants as well.
Yeah.
They are the offspring of giants, which we hear from biblical record as well. They survived into the modern era. The last ones to survive were the American Paleo-Indians.
Really?
Yeah, we'll get into that too. Now, the fifth race is the Garn, a cross between the little people and the fourth race, the Ihwan. Fully modern in type, Homo sapiens sapiens. You and I, you listening, we're gone. Beginning around the time of Apollo, 18,000 years ago in both the old and new worlds, stately but willful souls with all the arts and sciences of man, kings and born conquerors, masters of the sun kingdoms in the Mesolithic, they tamed the earth. We tamed the earth. So that's the five races. This is kind of the foundation that she's working from. So again, it was quite timely to read this today because I saw this tweet from Greg Little. I'll send it to you now, Aaron, so you can take a look and throw this one in the show notes or link to it in the show notes. And it's just, it gets so complicated with these ancient migration routes. Like, how do you get across there? how do you go from New Zealand to the tip of South America?
As he rightly points out, you've got genetic research, which, you know, demonstrates that these ancient migrations apparently took place and they move, you know, into the Americas, you know, through people living in Australia and New Zealand and the South Pacific. But you're right, it's such a vast distance to simply, you know, draw a line or an arrow on a map. I mean, were they seafaring? Is that being suggested?
I'm not saying they weren't capable of the journey. I'm just saying...
treacherous.
What they see, and this is from modern research that I'll mention as well, is that there's a genetic link between South Americans and Polynesians. There's also a cultural link. There's mythological links.
And language too, isn't
there? Language and artwork and pottery and all those things. And so there has to be some connection. So you see these long migrationary routes to try and explain it. As I said, I've got something much simpler, which I quickly drew on a piece of paper retweeted it.
Can you send me that? Let me have a look.
See if I can send it to you. Hang on, that's the wrong one. Let me send this to you. So throw this one in the show notes. Fixed it. Totally fixed it.
So you've just drawn a large landmass in the center of the Pacific Ocean, titling it Moo.
That's what it is. You got this giant empty Pacific Ocean, right? Mm-hmm. You've got people on either sides of it with the same mythology, culture, the roots of their language are the same. The way that their genetic lineages are connected. And
so they all fled a progenitor civilization that was once in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
That's more likely.
Yeah.
That there was a landmass there that they originated from And we'll go into this. We'll explain why this is a stronger case than these huge migratory routes all over the place.
You can't just draw an arrow next second. You're just like, I'm just going to draw a landmass.
Yeah.
Problem solved.
So they had four large arrows. I drew five short arrows. Trumped them all. Give me an honorary degree, please. So all these people, they came from Mu, a.k.a. Pan. This is what Martinez calls it. This is where she starts speaking about the forgotten island of Pacifica, Pan, Mu, lots of different names for it. And this
Atlantis
is...
Atlantis even.
Well, she points out what I was just saying. Have you ever wondered why the Pacific Ocean is so big and so empty? It's because there was a missing continent there.
But that doesn't necessarily, I mean, I'm not trying to dismiss, but you know what I mean? You can't just be like, well, because there's nothing there, clearly something must have been there.
Well, we've got more than that. We've got names associated with the missing continent and legends about this missing continent across the world. Mu, Tianmu, Waga, Lemuria, Lumania, Hiva, Helani, Fenuanui, Fusang, Pacifica, Rutas, Nadu, Kumari, and Pan. Approximately 24,000 years ago, she says, a great destruction sank this continent. The only survivors were the Ihin, the little people. So she argues that the flood myth was universal. Obviously, we know that. We've spent plenty of time on that in past shows. But it wasn't because the entire world flooded. There wasn't a global flood, according to her. It was situated in this area where this continent was. This is where the disaster occurred. The reason we have the legend of the flood across...
It's a global flood myth.
Across all different cultures is because the survivors, these little pygmy guys, took it with them to the all corners of the earth.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was out of this continent, Pan, she writes, that the Ihins escaped in separate fleets to the five divisions of earth. They went to Japan, America, Asia, India, and Africa, and proceeded to mix with the indigenous races, bringing about a renaissance of civilization in each of those places. These refugees sapienized the Near East, Europe, South America, Japan. They brought industry, tools, astronomy, temples, arts of peace. In each country, they founded colleges, they taught arts and sciences. And this explains why you saw this sudden flood of all these, this activity, all these people appearing around 25,000 years ago. She calls the study of this panology, which she admits she just made that up. But it reveals all sorts of surprises. Namely, Noah came from this continent. The whole story
of Noah was a pygmy?
Noah and the Ark. Noah was a little pygmy dude. And that explains how they got all the animals on the Ark. It's because they were all tiny. They had like little horses, little baby elephants.
Not so sure totally that that's accurate, no.
The proto-historian's version predicates that man's first civilization arose on Lemuria, whose emigres became the initiators who went to stimulate the development of civilizations in Egypt, Peru, the land of the Celts. This is why the Egyptian god Ptah, for example, who recreated the world after the flood, how is he depicted? He's a dwarf.
Really?
Yeah, he's a little dwarf. The sons of Noah were of the Ihin race. They were short, pale, bearded people. So again, this period is approximately 24,000 years ago, and it's understood by, you know, conventional science that this is a time of dramatic demographic dispersal of anatomically modern human beings. They were everywhere, going all over the place. They went in five directions. And this is where it gets really intriguing. These five directions, the five fleets, turns up all over the place. So she actually quotes the OASPI book, the one that was channeled by a dentist to start with, where it says, five great divisions of the earth there are, for the Lord established the five peoples who were saved from Pan. Now, there's two ways to think about the way people emerged in a modern perspective. You've got monogenism, which is the perspective of, I guess, the evolutionary theory in that there's one origin. So today we would say out of Africa. But there's another way to look at history, and that's polygenism, which is the separate development of races in several different locations on the Earth.
That it just makes more sense, though, doesn't it? Like, it just seems to make more sense. That's, I know, scientifically, you'd be shot down for saying that.
That's what the Chinese believe today.
Really?
Yeah, they don't follow the conventional evolutionary ideas. They believe that their race emerged from China.
Like traditional Han?
I don't know if it's traditional Han, but obviously there's an ancestor there, and they have their own kind of artifacts. They have their own fossil record, which they say is a different story, but that's a whole other thing. There's obviously political things going on there as well.
It's very difficult to believe a lot of stuff coming out.
So this idea, this polygenicist look at history is just another perspective. And one idea is that there were five different areas of the world where people originated from. And Carlton Kuhn, one of the world's leading polygenicists, actually believes this. He's wrote about this extensively. That's from his archaeological look at the fossil records. Like, obviously, there's five different locations where people emerged. But when you start to look at the ancient legends, this talk of five locations just turns up over and over again.
Mm.
So you look at ancient Sumatra. They talk about a soul ship. This is a ceremonial motif that has five figures on it. And it's a memorial to the land of their ancestors to the east. So you got five people on a ship from Sumatra. You have the Oceanic Malekulans. They attribute their megalithic building tradition to five culture-bearing brothers, white men with aquiline noses. In India, you have the Pandavas. Five heroes, brothers in the Mahabharata. Their name, based on Sanskrit, Pandu, meaning white, yellow, pale. A tradition of five brothers is also recalled in the Haida Indians of British Columbia. They say the first people came out of clamshells, which can also be interpreted as arcs, right? Clamshells, arcs. And they were five little bodies, according to this legend. And again, you go to Uaspe, this channeled work where it talks about the gods breathing upon the ships of their sons and daughters, blowing them about the ocean in each direction. It talks about four fleets of 34 ships, except two ships, which became the fifth fleet. And the Lord said, I will name the fleets of my chosen, and their five names shall be everlasting on earth. The Lord said, from these my seed, I will people the earth over in all its divisions, and they spread out all throughout the world. Now, here's another one for the show notes, Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to take a screenshot of petroglyphs found from all around the world. You've got ones from the Hopi, you've got ones from the Mayans, you've got ones from the Maoris, and they all show this boat. It's like an old carving of a boat. And tell me how many people are in each boat from each different culture.
I'm assuming it's going to be five.
Yeah, take a look.
It is. There you go. Yep.
Even this bone carving from ancient Mexico, five guys sitting in this boat. Now, there's even more here. There's Inuit drawings, there's an Assyrian relief, there's something painted on an Egyptian wall, there's an old Cro-Magnon aged carving. And what do they show?
Five little dudes.
A boat with five little dudes in it. This appears all over the world.
Is this, though, some type of, I'm just spitballing here, but like, because we have five fingers, so when people are, you know, drawing, the brain just seems to fill it with five. Is that like something that could be occurring, or is it more likely?
Oh, I mean, maybe in one or two cases, but it's the same pattern. And the same style boat and the same drawing.
Yeah, it's more than just
all over the place, all over the world. But there's more. You have the Irish Book of Invasions, these ancient records of the Nemhead. Five brothers bringing order, justice, and prosperity, establishing the five provinces of Ireland. These Nemedians had 34 ships that traveled the open sea in search of new lands. It's the same number.
Mm.
The name Nemedian is an anglicized changing of the word name hid, which means noble, sacrosanct, and worthy. So high culture, high people coming from afar, arriving in Ireland after the deluge. They were the king's poets, the forefathers of Ireland's divine race, the Tuatha De Danann. So something happened 24,000 years ago. In many places around the world, you saw this, like I said, this sudden injection of culture, sudden appearance of new types of people. And you can go to Europe for this as well, like the ancient, oldest paintings in France, you know, those cave paintings in France, they're dated 25,000 years old, roughly.
Yep.
Right? French cave art in Lascaux, in Montespan, dated at least 20,000 years old.
Is it Altamira? Is that the cave paintings?
Not sure about that.
Have to look that up.
The Lascaux paintings are very similar to South African cave art. Guess when that's dated to? 22,000 years, roughly. So it would seem that there was this, and people always talk, researchers always talk about this. You know, you've heard Graham Hancock and others say, well, this is some kind of explosion in creativity. It's like a shift in consciousness. You know, how many times have we heard that? Look at this explosion in art. It was a shift in consciousness. Maybe the people started taking mushrooms.
Yeah, well, when he's been describing it in the past, he was referring to 12,000 years ago when we had, what was it, Göbekli Tepe. Like some of the carvings that are there and this sudden, you know, it's a demonstration clearly of an advanced culture.
Well, these cave paintings, yeah, they're from 25,000 years ago, but maybe it's just because different people came and made these paintings. Mm. In Russia too, the earliest artists in the region from Lake Baikal, guess where they're dated to? The earliest rock art there, 23 to 24,000 years old. There's a burial site near Moscow, thousands of ivory beads, one of the earliest examples of jewelry in the world. The dating, 24,000 years ago. In Vladimir, Russia, there's a village that's said to be, guess what number? 24,000 years old. And that's where you see the spread of these Venus figures as well. You know, the big busty carvings of women from history,
yes.
The cult of Venus. These are dated in Russia at 24,000 years before the present. So again, you've got all these examples of this culture just appearing out of nowhere, new people appearing out of nowhere. Where did they all come from? And also there's a certain cranial morphology Martinez references.
In the art?
No, in the actual findings of these people. They had round heads. See, Russia appears to have been the hub of a widespread round-headed race. This is known as brachycephaly, and traditionally it's been thought of as a mutation,
mm-hmm.
right? Something changed, something went wrong. This is the head shape of these Ihin's little people from the continent Mu, from Pan. They had this kind of, they had this diminutive look and they had this round head. It's not a mutation, that was just how their skulls were. And again, these people were pale-skinned as well. So how many origin legends have we spoken of on the show, no matter where you go in the world, that speak about pale-skinned gods?
Oh, countless.
Yeah, look at the Polynesians. You've got their founder, Kon-Tiki, said to be bearded and white. The little people of Hawaii were always said to have pale skin. You've got bearded people being known to the Mapuche Indians, the Arawaks, the Incans. Builders of Brazil's Trans-Amazon Highway came across as white-skinned, red-bearded tribe called the Arsurinis, with a different language from the local dialects. The ancient Mexicans themselves, they're beardless, of course, but most of their deities, as we know quite famously, are pale-skinned, bearded entities.
Mm.
And it goes on and on and on. You can go to the Far East as well. And this is where it gets intriguing because look at Japan, for example. You've got the Ainu,
mm-hmm.
and it's a variant of the name, she argues, of the Inuit, which also comes from Ihin, the Ihin people. Inuit and Ihin, it's all linked.
So you mentioned Russia there because didn't the Ainu come and migrate down from Russia into Hokkaido?
Well, this is the idea. It's all through the land bridges, right?
Yeah.
Everyone's coming through these land bridges from one origin. But There's also been work from Sir John Franklin in the 19th century. He claimed in Alaskan people, in Inuits, he found blondes with blue eyes. Now, I saw something written about this recently because this was debunked, apparently. They did genetic research that couldn't find connections between Caucasoids and the genetic lineage of Inuits. But the problem,
then there's nothing.
But the problem with that is that they're looking in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Is, you know, they're not from Caucasians from Europe. That's not the connection. The connection goes back further to the origin of these little people who
right.
were fair skinned. That's why they couldn't find the genetic connection. And then you've got the early 20th century explorers who claim they found white Eskimos. I'll link to some of that stuff in the show notes. And if you look at Oceania directly, it reveals even more. They have legends, of course, of the Great Deluge as well. All the legends of Hawaii, and there's legends in New Zealand, they all talk about white-skinned race with fair hair that survived this deluge calamity. The New Zealand natives, the Maori, called that long-sunken land Haiwaiki, peopled over, they said, by an ancient Caucasian race from across the ores. The people from Flores in Indonesia have their own white Noah, the forefather of their tribe who was saved from a flood in a ship.
And yet, isn't that where they found the little pygmy
yeah,
person?
And this is where you find the remnants of this ancient pygmy race as well. You've got J. McMillan Brown, geologist, one-time chancellor of the University of New Zealand. He found it impossible to account for the remains on Easter Island without positing a submerged archipelago. There must have been a missing landmass, he thought, which had a centralized culture. And when you look at the island pictograms, like you look at Easter Island, and I'll send you another one for the show notes, they've got these pictograms, right? And they're identical to ones seen in India and China.
Send it through.
Take a look at this one.
Oh, how weird. Yeah. You can see the similarities.
And
are they holding something?
I think it's those little bags.
Oh, it's
I think
the bags.
They're holding those little bags
yep.
that have other little bags inside them. So today, when we're taught about the history of Australia, you know, some of the thinking is that there was migration from Southeast Asia. Obviously, there's the new out of Australia theory that some people put forward, but that hasn't really been taken on. Also, that people from Melanesia, their origins are from the mainland, like perhaps they came from China. But Martinez thinks a lot of this thinking is wrong. And when we come back to Polynesians, she argues that Polynesians didn't come from anywhere, which is...
What does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean? It's a little bit strange to say this. So
they had to originate somewhere.
If Oceania, this is what people say, this is the conventional understanding, Oceania owes its history to migrants from China or Singapore or Southeast Asia, right? But there's no links in mainland Asia to Austronesian languages. Like, there's no connection. The languages are completely different. They don't share anything at all. However, she points out that if you look at the languages that circle this giant empty space in the Pacific, what do you find? She says, one, they all use numerical classifiers. Number two, they all put the verb first in a sentence. And number three, they all have pronouns beginning with M and N. She says this suggests a wave of people spreading out from some lost oceanic center in all directions. So you've got vocabulary, numerals, grammar, all matching in Sundaland, Asia, Native Americans. It matches up with Polynesian languages. You've got to start asking, well, obviously, this is all the origin of one people. Where did they come from? Where did they end up?
And I was just thinking about, well, why is it that we haven't found any, you know, significant archaeological evidence for this? And the fact of the matter is that, first of all, it's 24,000 years ago. But secondly, if it somehow fell into the ocean, it's pretty hard to do an archaeological dig under the ocean.
Well, she says a lot of the evidence can be seen in the locations where these people went to.
Yes.
Yep. So, for example...
But you are looking for those similarities.
Right. So, one fleet went to China, for example. And China, of course, has its own deluge story that almost perfectly mirrors the story of Noah's Ark. It says the pillars of heaven were broken, the heavens sank lower towards the earth fell to pieces, and from the end of the flood onwards, you see these settlements all along the coast of China. The Uyghurs of China are remembered as the first civilizers in the old world after the flood. And there's a recent book called Forgotten Worlds by Patrick Chonard, where he talks about something we've mentioned on the show a bunch of times, is these blonde red-haired mummies found in China.
Mm.
They have Europoid features. And a lot of the times this has been linked to this idea that there's like lost Roman legions that ended up, that there's too many finds to suggest that one Roman legion went on to, you know, populate this entire area. His conclusion was that Asia was once home to a lost tribe of Caucasian population. And then you head to the Americas, this Ihin fleet of little pygmy guys, they reached America. The researcher Stephen Oppenheimer put this entering of the New World between 24,000 to 22,000 years ago, and they were pale-skinned. We see this in the Californian specimen, L.A. Man, dated at 24,000 years before present. And in the American Indian traditions, the flood survivors were little men of the mountains. Now, what's interesting here is that she's arguing that these little people were the mound builders. It's very controversial. You get banned from all sorts of stuff for saying that, but she says that's what the evidence points to. The mounds of North America were built by these first people.
Well, we've heard that, haven't we, with, you know, the Native Americans saying, with some of these mounds, we didn't make them.
Exactly. And what do they look like?
Little people, hobbit holes.
Little hobbit homes.
Yep.
Makes total sense. Am I wrong?
I don't know if you could just jump straight to that conclusion because they're tiny, but yes, I think we all see where you're going.
New DNA analysis also connects Native Americans to Asians, as we know. This has long been talked about. But it suggests they separated earlier than 15,000 years ago. And she says, well, it's probably 24,000 years ago that they separated, when this continent went down and they had to spread across different places in the earth. There's also cranial morphology that connects them as well. Like some fossil finds in the Americas, they have that round head, and in Asia as well. So, yeah, this is where it starts to get, kind of interesting, because she goes into these findings, these American Indians in Washington State, for example, near the Columbia River, that have Caucasian-like features. And we've heard this from, you know, some of the explorers in the 19th century talking about the white Indians. They have different features. They're paler skin, different structure to their faces. The morphology of the 9,000-year-old Kennewick man skull is also non-native. It resembles the Ainus. It's more Polynesian. It's not really Siberian. You've got Walter Nees from the University of Sao Paulo, who found links between the skulls of Polynesians and North American Paleo-Indians. You've got the anthropologist Marta La, who matched Patagonian skulls to South Pacific Islanders. Barry Fell, this Harvard paleontologist, was able to match skulls of Tennessee's ancient little people with lookalikes among the Negritos. Negritos are like pygmies, little brown pygmies, basically. They're from the Philippines.
So, but hang on, with all these finds, why are they not being looked at by the mainstream? Are they just kind of dismissed?
Because it refutes evolution.
Right.
It refutes evolution because what the picture starts to paint is different ancient races intermixing and breeding with each other. And that leads to the changes that proceed into the future. Not one dominant trait from evolutionary pressures. So species A ends up being successful and then species B quickly disappears.
Mm.
This, she's saying that this is refuting a lot of that thinking. And there's forensic evidence as well. Like she says, blood types indicate a strain of DNA in American Indians shows relationship to Pacific Islanders, not Siberians or Europeans, which is another thing because they're said to have come over that land bridge.
Yes.
Why don't they have that connection? Why is there scarcely any B blood type among American Indians, which is so common in Eastern Asia if they came across that land bridge?
Because it suggests that there's a lot of guesswork going on and gap filling.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And even the tools are found on the coast of California. The axe heads, for example, are exactly the same designs you find in the Pacific. Just a ton of these little connections she throws in here. So a lot of these migratory treks, they may have happened to some extent, but they're not the fundamental cause of why people are where they are. And when we head to South America, it becomes even more apparent. There's similarities in language. For example, the oldest Peruvian languages, they have great affinity with Polynesian languages, but only the old languages. All among the upper tributaries of the Amazon, there's reports of pale-skinned tribes still inhabiting there. And she mentions the infamous Percy Fawcett photographing the so-called white Indians all across Brazil's back villages. And they have legends of the Tahuamanu people who were white-bearded dwarfs, four-foot-tall pygmy men. And so this continues and continues until we get to Japan. What is the Japan connection? So I'd never heard this before. Apparently 42% of Japanese vocabulary is Malayo-Polynesian.
Really?
What? Is it really?
I had no idea.
Why does Japanese mythology, she asks, include so many elements reminiscent of Polynesia? So you look into Japanese history, and again, something happened 25,000 years ago.
Mm. Like a cataclysm?
Not a cataclysm, because the cataclysm happens in the middle of the Pacific to this nation of Mu. Everywhere else is fine. And then all of a sudden, all these new people arrive. And when you look into the history of these locations, it's seen in the record of their pottery, of their art, of whatever's built and left behind,
stone
monuments, oral traditions. Around this time, all the arts in Japan explode. We see an abundance of new tools, elaborate and sophisticated, suddenly appear, and we have the acclaimed Jomon potters. The Jomon people, the dominant race in the Japanese islands during the so-called Reign of the Gods, according to their legends.
Oh, the Reign of the Gods. So obviously an advanced race flooded into their country.
Yeah. These were the gods, their fine carvings done in relief, considered the oldest in all the world. And the Jomon ware, you know, the pottery and the things they created, has been compared to the pre-Inuit relics as well. It's like, what's the connection? Also identical, apparently, along the upper Amazon and Ecuadorian coast is pottery that is the same as the Jomon pottery in Japan. Jomon pottery has also been found in the Pacific itself, in Melanesia. Now, the earliest people, say the Japanese, were the Yamato. Who were the Yamato? Pale-skinned, diminutive men. In the prehistoric tombs of Japan are found the images of the Yamato called the Haniwa. These are little clay figures. They're little people. They're like little dwarves. Caucasian nobility said to have brought with them from the motherland a developed civilization.
What were they called?
The Yamato. These Jomon or Yamato folk also built megalithic stone circles. And again, remains have been found. They are 4.5 feet tall, and this is where they ended up. And another one of these five fleets ended up in Japan.
They're connected with the presence of large burial mounds.
Yep, because they lived in them.
Called Koh Phun.
It was their hobbit homes.
This is weird.
Isn't it weird?
It's really weird.
So at the same time, you find this flourishing in Japan, this explosion of Jomon pottery and tools and sophisticated new technology and culture, you find the same flourishing on the western shores of the Americas. You find it in Peru, Ecuador, and California. Is this meant to be some kind of coincidence that on the outskirts of this big empty Pacific Ocean, you find at exactly the same time in history this explosion in all this stuff. And not only is there an explosion in culture and art and tools, they literally are the same tools in some instances. Like what they've found in Ecuador is the same as the Jomon finds in Japan.
But could this suggest that they were a seafaring civilization? Could they have come from somewhere else? Could it, like, even though it kind of inhabits this ring, the specific ring, I suppose, could it be that they originated, like some of those theories about the out of Australia kind of theory, could they have originated there or New Zealand?
Well, that's exactly what this theory proposes, is that they were seafaring enough that when their homeland was destroyed, they were able to send their fleets out and seed their culture to these other locations. And essentially, when you get into the evolutionary argument, she says it's not evolution, they just started to breed with the natives. They started to mix races. And that led to what is ultimately different types of human beings.
So did they breed themselves out? Is that what occurred? Like, how come we don't have a lineage of them?
They just started to mix. They just eventually started. Well, the little people.
That's what I'm saying. We don't see little people getting around anymore.
Well, you do, though. That up until very recently, you did. Still pygmies. There's still diminutive people all around the world. And there was pygmies in Australia up until very recently. So their remnants, you know, it's not like they just vanished 10,000 years ago.
No, they were still around.
This is kind of a big hole that's been missing from history. And that's the prologue. That's like the first kind of introduction to what she's talking about. This is a huge book, and she lays out all her arguments for why this explains the origins of mankind. She sets the scene very early on for Asu, the first man, essentially the finds that we know, and we know them now as Ardipithecus ramidus, 4 foot tall, bipedal. It's called a foramen magnum, which means the neck and head were in line with the spine.
Oh, okay.
With apes, they jut forward, but obviously this one was upright. Yeah, you're right. So humans like us, bipedal, very small brain, didn't use fire or tools, no language, as I said at the start of the show. Basically morons. They're mentioned in the Vedas, and the term Asu means animalistic. They're also mentioned in the Old Testament, she says. Esau, Jacob's twin, described as being covered in red, shaggy hair. And again, these ancient men were covered in hair. It was said they were human-like but lacked a soul. They were without the spark of the divine. And that's why if you look at the Mayan ancient texts, she argues, they say that the predecessor race were beings of wood, which has always been really confusing, but it makes sense if you think of it in the terms of, well, they didn't really have the same divine spark that we have today. They were more animalistic.
Right, yeah.
They're like shells.
Logs.
Logs, yeah. Chaldean legend describes them as being like beasts. So the crux of Martinez's argument is that these beings mixed, as I said, with these diminutive pygmy dudes, the pygmy gods from Pan, from Mu. Now, if you look at the current understanding of these hominids, the Ardipithecus ramidus, even the Australopithecus, who were the offspring of this race mixing, there's long been two camps about their connection to Homo sapiens sapiens today. Like some experts would say, yeah, they're one of our ancestors. Others would say, no, they're just apes. And the idea that they were just apes, just kind of dead ends in the evolutionary idea, is what is considered correct today. And in fact, if you look at the other hominids like Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons, Denisovans, she points out that in the theory of evolution, they are these dead ends on this tree. Right. If you think of the evolutionary theory as this tree eventually leading to us, they're these branches that kind of split off from a common ancestor, but
don't go anywhere.
They went extinct. They stopped, right? They went away. She says instead of having an evolutionary tree, because all these hominid discoveries are now considered to be these dead end branches, it's no longer really a tree. She says it more becomes like a giant bush. Like, it's just all these branches that go nowhere. Now, she says The problem with this is that they didn't just disappear. They just all lived together and bred.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
It does.
That actually makes more sense because I assume that they're suggesting with these branches that have become extinct that there was so much genetic variability that there's no way that they would be able to interbreed. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
And we know this now from the, you know, we see pop science articles about, you know, you've the Denisovans were sleeping with the Homo sapiens. And we've all got like Neanderthal genes.
We do.
Yeah, we're all interbreeding. Everything's interbreeding.
So why is it that the Denisovans and the Neanderthals are so readily accepted, but any other branch is like, oh, no.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but she argues we don't need evolution at all to account for the ascent of man. All we need is the blending of types. And she says now that all these offshoots are arising, it's creating this problem. So now they're saying it's not even a tree anymore. It's not even a bush. It's now this network. She says, when will it end? So another thing that's challenged is this progression of evolution as well, that everything gets more advanced over time. And this is a whole other angle. We've covered this on multiple shows, that this is certainly not the case. Most traditions speak of a golden age. Mm-hmm. And you look at many ancient sites, and the further you dig down, the more sophisticated and advanced the stonework is,
yes.
the technology.
Or even like the methods to create alloys and that kind of stuff that we don't even know how to create today.
Yeah, exactly. And
like sophisticated knowledge.
Look at the stonework in South America. You look at the top layers and it's all over the place. It looks like a toddler
did it. Hodgepodge.
And you go down and the blocks get bigger and bigger as each older layer is revealed, until the oldest blocks are the most seamless, the most finely cut
and precise,
the most aesthetically pleasing as well. I mean, you see this with the pyramids. The oldest pyramid is easily the most impressive. The newer pyramids,
So are you suggesting that with this, I guess, evolution, technically it was a de-evolution because we lost this knowledge?
Well, here's where it gets intriguing when you look at it in the perspective of history. She talks about the Hopi legends, for example. Like the Hopi talk about the third age, where a mighty civilization, you know, big cities, Wakanda, basically. One of the Hopi elders, White Bear, spoke of nations, civilizations that were once there, but war and other evils destroyed them. And again, you see this all over the place. In different, you know, historical legends. Even Easter Island, like you dig further down and the statues are better than the more recent ones. But something happened that led to the destruction of these high civilizations in the ancient past. And one of the interesting things she puts forward is that, or one of the contributions, was cannibalism. They were eating each other.
And that dumped us down.
You remember on past shows we've covered the Native American legends of giants?
Yes.
And in so many...
Oh, they were all eating each other.
Yeah, in so many of the Native American legends.
Yes.
It was like these six-fingered giant freaks are coming and eating us. Like they're taking our women and children and they're cooking them and eating them.
Wasn't that from legends from New Zealand as well?
Yes. Yeah, so remember when we covered previous shows on that, you could find examples of this mythology all over the place. So this is where she goes into this idea that tribes of the Druks, remember the Druks were the giants, they covered the earth over. And there is some corroboration to this idea in the archaeological record, like Brinsley LePere Trench has seen that there was obviously cannibalism in Egypt around the time of Osiris. The Greeks had Polyphemus, which is around the same time, who was a notorious cannibal. There's the cave of Font Brugeaux in southeast France that has bones with cut marks on them, which show that...
You mean like teeth marks?
Well, like implements, tools to cut them up and eat them, like a knife and fork.
Mm.
So there were savages and cannibals everywhere, according to people that have looked into this, like enemies slain in battle and then cut up in cooking vessels. And then the cannibalistic giants, she argues, may have been the large Druks, the red-headed Goliaths that terrorized the Indians of Nevada until fairly recently. And who were the, was it the Anasazi? they're from Nevada, right? Anasazi. They're the ones that have the remnants of them. There's the caves. Like they used to live
in the walls.
They used to live in caves up in the walls.
Yeah, in the cliff.
It's always thought, like, why do they live up there? It was so hard to get to. Like, why would you have a house that's halfway up this cliff face?
Because you're staying away from cannibals.
Because a cannibalistic giant was trying to eat you. And you would climb up the rope, and then they would pull the rope up, and that's the only way you could survive. And if you look at the Judeo-Christian tradition, of course, we've got the Nephilim. But what did the Nephilim do? They brought the deluge upon the world.
So the Nephilim bring, because aren't the Nephilim supposed to be extraterrestrial? Did they bring a catastrophe?
Not in the traditional sense, since some people have suggested that. But no, the Nephilim were, you know, they were the giants that went astray. Like you've got Greek, Arabian, Roman, Peruvian traditions that also talk about these troublesome giants as being the cause of the flood, being the cause of the deluge. And one of the key things that links all these stories is they're all cannibals.
Mm.
They're all eating people. So it's like the Drux got out of control. Archaeologists sifting through the remains of these ancient people in Neanderthals have come across unmistakable evidence of man-eating. And she lists a bunch of them, like in Germany and Spain, you know, skulls. Like there's caves with dozens and dozens of skulls with the same puncture mark in the precisely same spot in every skull.
What, from trepanning or something?
No, it's like they had a system where they would scoop out the brains to eat them.
Oh.
But she says that it's clear what was going on, because also in these caves you've got, you know, bones with cuts on them and cooking implements and stuff like that. But the Orthodox researchers look at it and go, oh, well, clearly this was a cave of hyenas that ate their heads. It's like, no, this is ancient cannibalism. No, definitely hyena cave. What's it? The hyena chomped every skull in the exact same spot.
And yes, my boy.
The hyenas had bowls where they cooked human soup. Anyway, there's all sorts of examples. But at the same time as these cannibalistic giants being around, of course, there were the little people everywhere. And she includes this table of legends of little people as the oldest race. And you can go through Africa, Europe, Mexico, Mozambique, the United States. Like in Hawaii, they talk about the Menahune, the little people, the first race. Mozambique talk about the Yao, the first people ever seen, a tale of the beginning of the little men. Ghana has the small men, the first hero of the race made by the Anansi. No matter where you go, they're always considered the first people. The little people are the first people.
The problem with this is, though, is that if these were little people, do we have any understanding of how small they were? I mean, we're talking 3 feet,
yeah, 3 feet, feet tall.
They're 3 feet tall. So you've got this originator race that's 3 feet tall. They're going into breed with all these other species that are throughout the world. But these other species, are they standard height? So what I'm asking is, like, how do we end up getting people that we have at the height we have today, but also how do we also have giants? Like traditional evolution, I shouldn't say traditional, but the theory of evolution would actually explain why we have certain heights.
Because the Asu man, the very first, like the soulless man, was of that large stature.
Right, okay.
And then their offspring were larger as well, which led to all these other variations.
But then over the years, then that still has caused a form of evolution in the traditional, the Darwinian sense, that they have adapted to their environment. So maybe there's a possibility that the two theories are correct.
She's not saying there's any adaption at all. In fact, it's just genetic traits being passed on through interbreeding.
Right, which would respond, though, to environmental and selective pressures.
Maybe. I mean, she argues against it in a lot of cases. Like, that's one of the arguments for why you have pale skin and blonde hair, is that melanin, for example, was eventually weeded out through selection pressures, or maybe there was a mutation somewhere along the line.
Mm.
But she says if you look at the history of the diminutive people across the world, and they are in every continent, and she has a huge list of this, the Negritos, the pygmies, they're in Argentina, they're in Australia, Borneo, China, was the Kunlun people, Flanders, India, Indochina, Mexico, Thailand, on and on and on. They've all got pygmies, right? There's some history of them, or there's some evidence of them. They're all there. And they're all over the place. But also, you find evidence of the pale skin on every continent as well. So in Africa, you've got the Kalahari Bushmen who have paler skin. There's certain pale skin, blondism seen in some Aboriginal tribes. You've got the so-called milk-white Indians of Brazil. Chile has pale, bearded Mapuche Indians. The ancient Badarians of Egypt were small and fair. It doesn't matter where you go in the world. In every continent, Sri Lanka's got the Vedas, short, very pale, bearded people. You find evidence of these pale-skinned and pygmy individuals. Now, today, scientists say this loss of melanin, for example, is depigmentation, like I said, environmental pressure. But she says it's not. It's just from the gene pool because these fair-skinned pygmies were literally everywhere. So there would always be some genetic appearance of their features in every single culture. And she argues that if you look at all these people across the world, there are cases of this, whether it's pale-skinned American Indians,
yes,
or whether it's some pygmy in Australia. There's some genetic evidence of them being there. And there's clues in the language as well. So I love when she goes into this. All the sons of Noah, she says, are refugees from Mu. They were the Europoid type. They dispersed to every part of the world, carrying the name Mu into California. For example, so in California, you've got tribal names of Pimu and Limu. These people, as 16th century explorers documented, were fair and fine of form and demeanor. So you've got the conquistadors going into the Americas and like, oh, that's weird. It's fair-skinned Indians here. Now, if you look, there's also other examples of this Mu word appearing all over the world. In Kauai in Hawaii, you have the pale-skinned Mu people. In Arabia, you've got the Mu Zu. In Crete, you've got the Mu. And in Japan, you've got the Mukawa. Now, what's interesting is these are all port cities. It's where you would expect people to land, right, from somewhere else. You've got this language spoken by lighter-skinned tribal groups in northeastern Borneo. It's called Mu Rutik. In Australia, you've got a tribe of Aboriginals who appear to have lighter skin. Now, look these guys up today, and this, yes, some modern examples where they've probably got, European ancestry, but they looked pretty light-skinned, according to the Wikipedia article. They're known as the Murian tribe.
Murian, let me look them up.
There's also the Musca culture of Colombia, and they have legends of great flood and white gods. There's a Syrian village that's famed for having a Noah's Ark. It's called Mu Alaka. There's a city where it's apparently the founding of the Irish people. This is where they migrated. This is their founding place. It's called Murius. There's the ancient Egyptian word for the yellow race, Na Mu. And then finally, the perhaps politically incorrect term today, mulatto.
Mulatto?
Mulatto, a mixture of white and black.
Oh.
Which is, again, the argument. It's like pale-skinned, diminutive people interbred with other humans.
The question is, though, right, so I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but the term Mu, so clearly the suggestion is that it's because they've originated from a land known as Mu or something that sounds like Mu, and that's why it's spread out all across the world with them. Their language has come with them. But is there a possibility that this is just some type of way that speech develops? That, having kids, you see that they kind of speak the same way as they're growing up. You can see that they use the same kind of sounds, different kind of noises. Is that simply what's occurred here, that Moo or Moo is something that has just gotten into human language because of our physiology?
Again, if that was the only connection, then yeah, sure. But it's the thing is, it's not
a greater.
The only connection. You got to take all these examples and kind of view them. You got to step back and view the bigger picture. Another example is the legends and history of giants and dwarves being in the same place.
Yes.
And this also includes historical artifacts and finds as well. So in Australia, again, in northeast Queensland, we clearly had pygmies, a tribe of pygmies. But according to her, there's also been 23-inch footprints of ancient upright hominids found in our country.
So were they battling?
No, see, this is one of the things. She says they weren't, you know, people today, this is a very modern mindset, right? We're taught, firstly, because of this evolutionary theory and the survival of the fittest, we're taught to think that everything in ancient history was a battle for supremacy.
Yes.
And the winners took all and the losers went extinct and were gone forever. She argues this is not the case. And in fact, cooperation is more likely the state of affairs for ancient people because everyone wants to survive. You want mutual benefit for both parties. People want to prosper and survive, and they do this through cooperation. It's the same argument that, you know, some you know, feminists might have about men oppressing women throughout history, but the true history is men and women cooperating, working together. You know, there's this idea that one, you know, particular group forced down the other throughout all of history. It's a very kind of modern or postmodern, you might say, way of thinking about things. And it's almost like a disease of thinking.
Like a mind virus, perhaps?
Perhaps kind of a mind virus. And, you know, this is seen in the some of the ancient tales. You go to Brazil, they've got bearded little white dwarfs in history, but they've also got 7-foot skeletons that have been found.
Have probably gone to the Smithsonian and been covered up.
In China, you've got the 4-foot tall wild men, but you've also got the Gigantopithecus. Tipithecus. You know the one I'm talking about. Tipithecus.
No, it's Gigantopithecus, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one. Also in Denmark, you've got the Little Danes of the Stone Age mounds. Again, mounds, little people, and the Tall Danes of today. France, you've got the Laminaks, which were like the little tiny dwarf-like people. And you've got the giant Tartaros. There's an enormous skeleton that was found near Chaumont Castle. India, you've got the Vedas, which were the little people. But you've also got the Daityas Hanrayakashapa, which were these 2-foot long footprints and apparently 11-foot tall skeletons. The list goes on and on, again, all over the world, suggesting that these ancient people, different people, like today, of course, there's wars, there's animosity, there's fighting.
Exactly, but people draw lines across, you know, multiple reasons. You look at the last world wars. You know, like it was the same groups of people that they just drew a line. They went, well, no, you're from this country, you're from that country, and that was it. That was why the war happened. So yeah, this idea, it's actually a really good point, Ben, that you go, oh, well, just because they're different, you know, subspecies or whatever, that they would war with each other, it's actually quite absurd.
Yeah, I do feel like this is kind of modern thinking coming in to this idea of history. Let me give you one example from Germany where Germany's little people.
And they had little people?
Yeah, so there's apparently been 4-foot, 8-inch skeletons unearthed near Bonn. Now, a lot of these finds are from like the late 1800s and then never heard from again.
Yeah, right.
Admittedly, I don't know that case, so maybe that's more modern. But there's also giant tombs found in Hunengraben as well. So this Germany, great example, you find little people, you find giants, and you find this in the traditions as well. This is in the fairy tales. This is in the mythology. There's a tradition amongst the peasantry of the German states that God created the giants to slay the wild beasts and great dragons to ensure the safety of the sacred dwarves. So this is a legend. It's echoed in the Oaspe Bible as well, which talks about the mighty men of old that were tasked with slaying all dangerous beasts and being defenders of the Ihins, the little people. But according to these old legends, these giants did their task. They became protectors of the dwarves, but eventually they came to oppress the dwarves, which kind of goes against my earlier argument.
That one group would oppress another is absurd.
It actually was oppression.
Until it happened.
I think they just ate them like Skittles. They just like picked them up, like grab a couple. Yeah, it's like a little roast chicken. but they had become altogether wicked and faithless, these giants. And that was the cause in many traditions of the flood, as we mentioned. So you see this also with the Arikara Indians in America. It said the creator caused a flood to get rid of these unruly giants, but saved the little people by, quote, storing them in a cave. You've got the Pima creation myth that involves the salvation of the elect from a great flood. This also continues into the myths of Apollo slain by Python, Osiris slain by Typhon, Bacchus slain by Titans. This is the slaughter of the old world priests and essentially the sacred tribes of the little people at the hands of these degenerate hordes of Drooks, these giants. So she's got many more examples of these, and I'm running out of time, so I won't be able to go into these, but it's just a perfect example of how this is everywhere. It's the same mythology in New Guinea. And it's actually the same mythology in Cain and Abel. Like, if you look at the tradition from the Bible, Cain slew his brother Abel, quote, after he went forth with an impious race, forgetters and defiers of the true God. That's the giants, right? All nations preserve the remembrance of that division of the human family into the righteous and the impious. And Abel was a prototype of the sacred people. Because Abel could understand God, right? He was capable of hearing the voice of God. He represents the little people who were the original high race who came from this advanced civilization. But Cain slew Abel. He was like the Drooks, the giants that had become corrupt. They became the cannibals, the warlike ones.
The question is, though, how does she know this is what happened? Is it just from the legends, like these oral tradition legends?
So if you look through the book, and again, I'll link to it in the show notes, she's connecting mythology, but also the fossil record, modern anthropology, pottery discoveries, linguistic discoveries, and kind of tying it all together in this big picture. Right. Now, she may be wrong about some things, but in a broad stroke, it makes sense in a way. But ultimately, the question comes to this, and I found myself asking this over and over as I was reading through this today. Okay, I get it, that these advanced little people came from this island where they had an advanced civilization, disaster struck, they spread across the world, brought their culture and civilization and intermixed with various other native races. Ultimately, this intermixing continued through history until we have us today.
Mm-hmm.
But where did the little guys come from?
That's a good question.
Where did they come from? Well, we're going to answer that after the break. And the origins aren't from this earth.
There you go. Is it subterrestrial?
That's coming up after this on Mysterious Universe. Plus, get your extension today. Sign up at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. We do these big extensions on the shows every single Friday. We should just call it the second half of the show. Because it is like the same length.
It is, yes. It does
large. You also get an entirely exclusive show, of course, on Tuesdays as well. We've got concurrent running seasons and a season exclusive plus members. Check it out today, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. And if you sign up for our MU Max tier, you get access to our entire back catalog. And plus members also, of course, get access to an ad-free version of the show, a higher quality MP3 version of the show as well. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus helps support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Aaron's got some amazing stuff coming up. Looking forward to hearing from that. Remind me what it was again.
Phantom birds escaping from people's mouths while they're sleeping. Right. Weird snakes doing the same kind of thing. The origin of werewolves. Weird object permanence. Ghost chairs draped in stars.
Ghost chimps?
Chairs, not chimps. Although, yes, yeah, so you're probably right. Ghost chimps would probably be a better story.
I was trying to spice it up. Like a ghost chair. A guy goes to sit in a chair and then the chair disappears and he falls over. It's like slapstick paranormal.
Oh, you just told the whole story, Ben. I mean, there's no point anymore. No, it's very different. It ties into this whole theory of the dark matter pilot wave, which might give us an umbrella understanding as to why all this phenomena occurs, and it's all about this hidden substance that science doesn't yet fully recognize, but it definitely is there.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. Again, Susan Martinez's The Mysterious Origins of Hybrid Man will be linked to in the show notes. Another great alternative to evolutionary theory, if you want to open your mind to that. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around after the break for all the good stuff. Plus extension, great to have you with us. Let's